you hear that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like. X-Go, give it to you. How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Beosonic sound experience. That's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it? X-Go, give it to you. Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S. Give up. Order now at Acura.com.
Selling smoothies is what I do, but for small business insurance, I chose my State Farm agent. He's a small business owner, too, so he knew how to help me personalize my policies. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to an agent today.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 bacon bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the bacon cheese slider, 1921 bacon cheese slider, or chicken bacon ranch slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 bacon bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour, and they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com, to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Welcome to Dugout Study Hall, a proud member of the Pitcher List Podcast Network. You can find the show at Dugout Study Hall and Alexander and I at Chase_Rate and at The Corked Matt, all on Twitter. Email us at dugoutstudyhall@gmail.com with your comments and questions. On this episode, we will talk about some players we expected to do great things in 2021 who struggled and, dare we say, busted. We will also talk about fantasy pet peeves and whether the last week of the regular season should factor into your fantasy playoffs. But before we get to all of that, Alexander, how you doing?
Matt, I am not doing too bad today. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty well as well. I hear that you had to do a little furniture movement today. Let's deep dive into that. We got our recording delayed just a touch here, and I have to know what was going on.
So we're getting rid of a TV stand. Because we had too much black IKEA furniture in my home, and apparently that was messing with some things. So we got rid of one of them, and we got someone to come pick it up and pay us money for it, which is a real win.
That's huge. It's not just having to get rid of it. It's having somebody pay you for the privilege. It can happen to the best of us, too much of that IKEA stuff lying around. Yeah, I think we're all probably guilty of that to a certain extent. Well, I'm happy for you. I'm happy you were able to ditch it and make some cash in the process. All right, I want to jump into the bell ringer here a little earlier than we normally do, and we're going to skip our weather conversation because it's due for us to just not talk about it. And I want to ask you, now that the fantasy baseball season is coming to a close, maybe for some people you're already out of it, and I'm sorry for you. There can only be one winner in each league, right? So most people walk away just a little disappointed, at least. What is your biggest pet peeve about fantasy baseball in general? The thing that kind of just irks you the most that you would love to change if you could?
How much time do you have?
Well, we don't have a whole lot of time, so maybe pick your favorite pet peeve. If you've got like a whole farm of pet peeves.
I'm going to limit this specifically to fantasy. I tend to find a lot of like the draft discourse about like value to be kind of weird, where it's like, you know, like you got to make sure you reach for these guys. I find that in particular is like a subset of like discussion. It's like which guys you got to like be willing to just like throw out the book in good process for, because it's like, oh, yep, if you don't get him, you're going to lose. I'm like, that feels wrong.
Yeah.
And it feels like we're going to get back there here in like 4 months, where like, whoever like Fernando Tatis Jr. is going to be, we'll see. Like,
Fernando Tatis Jr. I like that. The next Vlad Guerrero.
Yeah. Yes. We can keep doing this. The next Bo Bichette.
Yeah. I don't know if it would make a great pod if we just spent 45 minutes listing players.
Hey, these are all people who are themselves juniors. It works.
That's true. Yeah, that is true. Interestingly enough, it was, I don't know if you caught this or not, but Vlad hit his 40th, and now there's only two sets. There was only one. There are now two sets, but still, that's not a lot of father-son combinations with 40 home run seasons. The Guerreros and the Fielders. It's the Fielders.
Mm-hmm. That sounds right to me. Yeah. The very particular thing that I feel like I'm pointing to is, you know, a lot of the kind of gambling driven decisions that people will make, I tend to find very like unanalytical, but also uninteresting, because like most people I know don't spend just gobs of money on like NFBC, and there are some people who do, and I feel like a lot of people who like tune into their content are just doing it to kind of live vicariously through them, not because they're like depending on their analysis for like one-to-one also NFBC content. Like, it's just like you're spending a lot of money, and that means that the people you're playing against must be trying really hard, right? And you know, there's this whole like section of like strategy built around it, and there's some really smart people who play those and make money,
right? Definitely.
But I feel like we have to treat it as what it is.
Well, it's a very different animal. I mean, if you're playing in a head-to-head roto not roto categories or a head-to-head points league, you know, with playoffs, it's okay if you finish third. If you're playing one of those money leagues, especially if it's got an overall, the mindset is you have to go all in, because finishing second is the same as finishing 12th or 15th or whatever your league size is. So it's a totally different mindset, and I get that. And I've said before, I don't take that away from anybody, but I do think it's really important that people know where the advice they're listening to is coming from and the function and purpose. And I think a lot of people putting that out there are fairly good at saying like, hey, listen, this is what we're doing. And this is kind of the context, but I don't know if everybody who's kind of digesting that and consuming that really is hearing that.
I think maybe I could refine the thing that annoys me most is that, but you can't do that if you're trying to win the overall. Anytime I hear those words, there's just a part of me that's just like, where is the nearest like blunt object I can like forehead on? Listen,
a lot of people aren't doing that. Right. So
I don't have the money to do that. Yeah.
It's a totally different animal. You're really playing two different games. It's like looking at roto ranks for a points league. It's just you're talking apples and oranges. So,
I think there are a lot of people who can do that stuff and kind of make those caveats in like a smart way, but it's typically about their own analysis. It's usually when that's an interjection against something that like someone else has said, you know, like you're bringing that into the discussion. Very unnecessarily. I think that's the thing if I finally can put it on that, like, you would think that's too niche, and it won't be. So,
It doesn't surprise me that your pet peeve is analytics driven. Mine is far more simple, and that is people who are incredibly difficult to trade with. Trades in fantasy baseball. Yes. Are really exciting and fun, and I've gotten to the point in a lot of places where the frustration outweighs the eventual benefit of swinging a deal, and I think this year I I just stopped trying a lot of places and cases. And listen, I understand people don't want to be the one to give up the next big thing, but asking prices for people who aren't quite what they may be, you can't ask people to be paying what they might turn into before they've turned into it. So yeah. That's the thing that bothers me and I feel like it's getting worse. And actually, I think it might be a little bit linked to what you're talking about, because a lot of this analysis that's driven by, putting all your chips in the center of the table to try and be in first place or win an overall has put a lot of pressure, I think, on people hearing and wanting to be the one who owns the next big thing or the guy who's about to break out. And you hear a lot of, oh, that's my guy. I can't trade that. Like, okay, but, you're not going to swing a lot of deals and make your team better if all of the guys on your roster are awesome and all the guys on my roster are terrible and undervalued. It's just, you're never going to get to a happy medium.
Yeah, there's a home league I'm in that's kind of keeper dynasty-ish, and I'm sitting in second. It seems like that might be where I land if I'm not careful. There's a guy who's probably going to win the league, and he's probably made 25 or 30 trades this year, most of which have been fair and reasonable. He's just constantly trying to churn through things and doesn't think of his players that way, and it's allowed him to rebuild this team really quickly. I have probably traded with him 10 or 15 times this year, and it's helped me kind of do the same thing. I've won some of them really, really like easily, and I've lost a few of them pretty badly. And it's way more fun that way.
Yeah. If you're decent at it, you're going to lose trades. But in the end, you're hoping you win more than you lose and you come out slightly ahead. If you're winning every trade, if you're annihilating the rest of the league in every trade you make, if you're just getting tons and tons of value, then, I mean, there's something wrong about that in terms of like the balance of the league or the skill set of the league or whatever's going on. You shouldn't be able to fleece people all the time. It just shouldn't work that way. Anyway, that's my biggest pet peeve, is that I think either it's my experience that trading has become more difficult, or it's a kind of an industry-wide thing where people are just planting a lot of flags and unwilling to part with players, not necessarily for actual value reasons.
Now, one more kind of like caveat on your point there. A lot of those gambling style leagues where there are overall components, for the sake of fairness, don't allow trades, which, by the way, has the knock-on effect of making steals and saves much more expensive on draft day than they otherwise would be, because you can't trade with your league mates for them if they end up having an excess for what would be a normal league, because they're trying to win like an overall steals sort of title, which is, it is what it is, I guess.
Totally different. It's like scratch offs and numbers, like, in the lottery. You're just playing two different games. They're both lottery, but they're completely different. Anyway, I think we've made our point, so I will move on. I apologize for beating that dead horse, but
was there something that drew this up out of nowhere to make you ask me so you can get on your high horse about trades?
This isn't something that, like, in my one of my home leagues, like, is driving me nuts. No, not at all. I just was curious. I think, like, I don't know, I tend to be a little bit of a reflective person just in general. And so as I'm getting towards the end here, and there were a number of leagues that I got destroyed in, just very bad showing. And then in my two home leagues, I'm in the playoffs, and that's, it's just kind of interesting to think about, like, how did I get there? What's the difference? And in a lot of cases, it's who's in some of these leagues. My Nerf league, Roto's not my thing, and there's a lot of heavy hitters in there, and it just wasn't my year for any of that sort of thing. So I don't know. I think it was just born out of reflection of, like, hey, what can I do differently next year? What do I need to work on? Especially to make sure that it stays fun. I think that there was a time that I had this year where I actually, it was causing me anxiety because things weren't going well, and that just made me ignore it a little bit because it was giving me anxiety, and then that certainly didn't help. In the end, it's fantasy baseball, and I needed to prioritize my headspace. So a lot of that thinking as well, but I was just curious. I kind of had a feeling we would be coming at it from two different places as well, so that's always kind of fun. All right, I want to move into our number of the week. And this is kind of a bizarre number. Maybe it's not. I don't know. But I don't really quite understand what this number is. And I'll tell the story about how I came to this number afterwards, because I do want you to try and guess the player. I love playing guess the player. And when it's one player against the field, it's so unfair to you, but it's still fun for me. So I want to bring up this number, and maybe you can help me understand the number that I'm going to talk about. If you go to the FanGraphs page for a player, over where it says WAR, there are a couple of other categories there that look like almost like WAR is being calculated by base running WAR plus offensive WAR plus defensive WAR equals WAR. But it doesn't say WAR. It says OFF. And for this player, that number is a -23.6. And that is poignant and that is important as we move forward, because I don't quite entirely grasp what this is, but I know it's not good. And combined with some other numbers, I think we'll paint that picture. But could you explain to me for a minute here, maybe even less than a minute, what exactly is that number telling us? Because it's there and it's easy to see, but it's not super clear.
Okay, so I'm going to start by what it isn't. Okay. So this player is not like worth 23 losses to their team on offense. So that would be
really bad.
Notable, historic, fun, maybe. No, on reflection, no, not fun. So that is like weighted offensive runs above average. It's negative, so it ends up being below average.
Right.
So you take a replacement level player and you plug them into a team's lineup. How many more or fewer runs would your team score as a result? Well, this person's performance has been bad enough that their team would have scored about 23, 24 fewer runs. They would have scored 24 more runs, right, if they had a replacement level player.
Average, yeah. Which still doesn't strike me as being very good, but is significantly less damaging than 23 wins.
Yeah. The going conversion rate there, according to FanGraphs, is about 10 runs per win.
Okay.
So that's like about 2.5, coming up on 2.5 losses, depending on where the year lands for this player. And I'm trying to figure out who would get long enough of a leash to get there, and it is...
It's interesting. It really is an oof. I'm going to give you some more numbers for context. I thank you for explaining that so that it's clear. I'm going to give you some more numbers for this player. 126 games, 504 plane appearances, 25 home runs, 173 batting average on a 192 BABIP, yielding a 70 WRC+.
Okay, I got one guess for this. This is Eugenio Suarez.
It is. You got it. Yes. I need
the
sound
home
effects.
Runs give it away. Yeah.
I need sound effects and party hats and what are those things that shoot out when you blow into them? Are the noisemakers or something? Yeah, that's really good. That's a really good pull from the field to get the one player that this is. Yeah, that's not great, and that's certainly not what people were expecting going into the season. So we can use this, I think, as a jumping off point into our central question, which is like, what happened to some of these guys that were supposed to be really good? Some top 25 players, a couple of young guys that were supposed to be something and maybe didn't pan out. And maybe more importantly, what does that mean for how we dig into and analyze them for next year? Are they going to be values, or are they going to be not even worth, you know, on the do not draft list? And we can start with Eugenio Suarez, because that's where we were.
Yeah. I think that this is a good exercise for us to do before the computers start to tell us what to think at the end of the season. Now you can already go. And when I say the computers, those are people. The people made those lines of code, which is a number that someone has told you what to think about. And I have tried my hand at a lot of that stuff. And it is fundamentally a reflection of how you look at things. And these numbers don't mean anything unless we got some narrative to them. Mm-hmm. So all that aside, I think it's worth our while to start this conversation and think about these things before we have something trying to bias our opinion too much. Now, you can go to like a Razzball player rater, or you can type people's stuff into like the FanGraphs auction calculator and get like a pretty good measure of how many dollars won or lost someone has provided for you this year mm-hmm. in your league settings. But I think it's really important before you even head into all of that to kind of take stock of who a player actually has been and why. Because there's a lot that these computers cannot and will not even try to know. And you should not put yourself in a position where you're just sorting by dollars or sorting by home runs projected next year, because you're going to miss a whole lot.
Yeah, I think just that's like a good way to look at this is like there's the numbers that the average player is going to go and look at on ESPN or Yahoo or whatever. And they're going to be looking at things, the stock numbers, right? Average and home runs and RBIs and steals, if that counts in your league. And then there's the FanGraphs deeper dive stuff. And I guess obviously we're looking at somebody with a 173 average. That's not going to show as great, but he did still hit 25 home runs. So, you know, if you're looking at somebody like Eugenio Suarez, are we expecting him to bounce back next year, or, you know, what are the underlying numbers say? Which underlying numbers should we look at and trust in to give us a better idea of what's going to be good or not good next year?
Yeah, so I think it's kind of worth sorting through what we expect our competition, if you want to look at it that way, to care about most. It's probably like pretty trite at this point to just like complain about StatCast sliders. we're going to complain about StatCast sliders.
We've never done that. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. I have some quibbles there. I've actually like kind of gotten off that high horse to a degree, because like at the end of the day, like everyone's kind of in the same boat about it. And like, here's some information. They're doing their best to tell you some relatively important things.
Yeah, it certainly isn't useless. Yeah. I think it's just important to note that for somebody who doesn't know their way around what's under the sliders, they can be a little misleading in terms of the picture that they paint. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good way to say it, what's going on underneath them, because really it is just a glance, and then there's a lot of numbers, and it can be kind of scary. So the questions I want to be able to ask myself is, you know, like, did someone's skills get better or worse? Mm-hmm. Did someone, like, have some other sort of change that explains everything really, really easily that we can kind of point to that's off the page? Or were our expectations off?
Right.
And I think for Suarez, it's a lot of different things. He's a really fun case. So let's kind of like talk through a couple of things that changed for him. So first and foremost, I think if there's one number I do want to kind of just like run to towards the top, it is like someone's like strikeout and walk numbers, because those are like not misleading at all. So I just want to say like those percentiles, great. I do not, however, care meaningfully about someone's whiff rate and chase rate in isolation. I do like to look at them and see if there's some trends from previous years to see if we were like missed something and there were some signs. But I would say those ones I'm not going to care as much about. So what's the deal with Suarez there? Well, his strikeout numbers have been ticking up for a few years, but like 2019 or so. Yeah, 2019. His strikeout rate jumped 5%. You'll notice that's also a year that something else somewhat important happened, and that he hit 49 home runs. He had a pretty good 2018 where he hit 34 home runs. The average was a little bit better. The OBP was a little bit better, but you know, it's basically what if you were just automatically out 5% of the time more, but you just hit for significantly more power. That was a trade he made. And that trade
seems and purposeful. It must have been purposeful, right? That's,
you know, so there's a couple ways you can go and look at that, right? So you'll notice that he starts chasing more. He was sitting at about 21.8, 21.6 couple back years, and then suddenly he jumps up to about 24%. So that's like 3% more outside the zone pitches he's going after. His in the zone contact starts to edge down too. So this is someone who's really going for it.
Yeah,
this is a purposeful change. And yeah, so you can see like he has made a decision. That's not just talent changing, and those are the sorts of things you want to look for. Because
let me ask
choices
you this.
Matter more than talent in a lot of cases.
Yeah, definitely. And I don't mean to derail this conversation at all. I want to jump in with a thought that I just had. Is this maybe something also to do with the idea that like pitchers are getting better at tunneling and release points and all of that, right? And so if a player has decided like the pitch is coming in here and I'm swinging out of my shoes at it, and if it happens to be the slider, I'm going to miss it. But if it's the fastball, I'm going to crush it to Milwaukee. And I'm fine with that. And I'm going to wind up striking out more because it's going to show that I'm swinging at pitches out of the zone. But what I'm doing isn't really chasing pitches out of the zone as much as zeroing in at a point and deciding to swing at that pitch. And it's fine if it winds up being the wrong pitch. Am I way off here?
That's definitely something that some people do. I would have to look some more about like Suarez's relative contact rates and different pitches over time. Yeah, but
fair enough.
I'm willing to bet, though, that if you go looking for those things, the story will tell us that he is maybe he's just choking up less. I don't know. But yeah. He's going for it more often.
Yeah, one way for or sure. Another.
And that really panned out in 2019. But what's happened since 2019? That's like the baseline expectation for him that we've drafted on 2 years in a row, right? So strikeouts have ticked up just a little bit. Last year, the power was even better in theory than it was in 2019. But this year, in some ways, not all, but in some ways, that power has kind of taken a dive. So I'm going to kind of like just throw some numbers out that people would see. His barrel rate is functionally the same, right? He's been like about 14% past 3 years in terms of barrel rate, which is like the number of barrels based off of contact. Now, the amount of contact he's produced has been basically the same. So that's comparable. I won't do my whole complaint about barrel rate just yet. It's coming. The thing is, though, his like non like really teed up quality contact has nosedived. So his sweet spot rate, that's like whenever you've got an ideal-ish combination of like launch angle, actually just launch angle. It's not a combination. It's just like, did you hit the ball in like the line drive, but it's a little bit more than line drive combination. They'll just like land the ball in play basically most of the time. Gone from about 38% to 30 over the past 2 years. Players don't have a tremendous amount of control over that. League-wide average for sweet spot rate is about 33% this year. So he had a couple years running where he was exceeding that pretty significantly. You should probably think that that is due in some part to approach, where you are taking a little bit off power-wise some of the time, especially probably with two strikes, in hopes that you can probably hit it more at like the spray and stuff that you would want to kind of like get a hit. So he stopped like trying to hit for average in some cases, really goes for it, and that shows up in sweet spot rate. Now, the other concerning thing then is that this year in particular, his line drive rate, the particular part of sweet spot that is just like even better, right, has also fallen off a cliff. Now, these are things for me that are instruments that measure the luck that a player has before the ball even gets to a defender. You can be the sort of lucky where, you know, like Derek Jeter's the shortstop you're hitting the ball towards, or whatever you want to make the joke these days. I don't know. Congrats to him. I'm getting into the hall.
Yeah,
also.
That's true. Congrats. I'll give him his due for one day.
Yeah, he wasn't always terrible. It's just fun to make fun of him. fun to make fun of Yankees fans. I think that's the correct way to put it. But yeah, so Suarez had run some like above league average line drive rates early in his career. He starts going for it, falls off a cliff. That does not mean that he has gotten worse. There are plenty of people who go for it, who hit a ton of line drives. It's not something you have a whole lot of control over. So there are a lot of signs here that would say that Suarez made some choices that really just the stars aligned in 2019. Now, what's the other thing that's happened? They dejuiced the ball. So he's getting a little bit less out of his hard contact than he otherwise would, probably. And he's been way, way less lucky in terms of quality of contact. He's probably also like lost some confidence somewhere along the way. I wouldn't.
Yeah. Well, can I ask this question too? If you were to overlay a narrative of he's a little injured and his bat speed is a little bit less, or he's a couple years older and he's not getting around on the ball that much, would that be something that could also explain these changes aside from just he's doing what he's doing and it's just not going his way?
You know, that's probably in there to some degree. Now, if you look around, like his contact rate, like or his zone contact rate, things like that, those look pretty much the same. He's whiffing like 1% more than he was in 2019. In the zone, yeah, he's making actually a little bit more contact in the zone than he was in 2019. So those things look the same. His hard hit rate, you know, percentage of balls that he makes contact with that have been hit hard, 95 miles an hour or more, is down from a couple years ago, and that might be the one thing that would tell me maybe he does kind of have something that lingered from a previous injury, or who knows. But it seems like the, like, well, actually, a thing about that, though, is that you tend to hit the ball really hard when you line it up well. So by virtue of him just not making as much really great contact as he previously had, he's probably had a few fewer out of 100 that are just smoked. And players don't control that all that much. He could very easily, based off of those sorts of conclusions, that's like very quickly a path I'm always going down on for a player. Have they started whiffing more? Have they started chasing more? Have they started hitting the ball hard more often? And have they been really unlucky in terms of like quality of contact? Those are the things I just immediately want to answer for a player. And the big reason there is those numbers stabilize quickly. Things like barrel rate. Now, it was flat here for him for a lot of these. Those take a long time to become stable. And players don't have as much control over it as we think, because you got to be able to hit line drives or hit it in the sweet spot roughly. And you don't have as much control over that as people like to believe. That's why people don't have batting averages in the 400s.
You can hit line drives, you can
do it all the time.
Exactly.
So I'm really glad we get to start off with Suarez, because he gets to talk. He gets to be an example for this thing that I care about deeply and that I think kind of goes under the radar a lot of the time. So
I want to ask you this before we move on from him, as and maybe we can kind of include this in at the end of an analysis for each of these players. But in the end, yes, his 173 average isn't telling us the story. But next year, that's going to be what counts in my fantasy league, right? I mean, if I'm in a roto league that has average, that's what counts. And I want to draft somebody who's going to contribute to my batting average or to my home run total or, right? So what would you say is the most likely outcome for next year, that we're going to see regression back to his mean, which would be a good thing, or that his approach is just not working for him and he's just as likely to not figure it out as he is to figure it out?
So obviously the playing time question, they've kind of like taken away some of his plate appearances this year.
Well, I mean, to be fair, that's because he's hitting 173.
I would do that if I was trying to make the playoffs and I was, you know, in charge of a baseball team. Like, I get it. Even if the underlying stuff says this guy shouldn't have been this bad, that doesn't mean that he won't press and change his mechanics and do bad things to try to get out of that slump. Like, what happens. Failure begets failure in some really terrible ways in baseball. But, you know, in a robot world where he is just kind of like a roll of the dice over and over again, you'd probably bet that his batting average is somewhere close to 240. If he's hitting a normal number of line drives and sweet spot balls or something closer to it than he currently is, that extra 4%, like 4% of plate appearances that are line drives or sweet spot balls, that will add probably 20 or 30 points to his expected batting average, which is currently 203. So like, you could see him having somewhere between 230 and 240 rather than 170. And if he has a lot of power, then we got someone who is probably going to go pretty late in the drafts and could emulate to a degree like a Joey Gallo or like there's so many guys like who fit in this mold that are totally rosterable in every single format.
Right.
So he also has the benefit of playing on a reasonably okay team in a really good hitter's park.
So you're reasonably comfortable saying that if his stock drops pretty significantly, he's value on draft day.
Oh yeah. I mean, I would want to hopefully get him in like a league that has like middle infield and corner infield spots, so I can have someone else ahead of him in the pecking order of these positions.
Right.
But he would be a fantastic multi-positional roll of the dice towards the end of drafts for like $5. That'd be stoked to get next year based off of these numbers alone, as long as he doesn't just get like yeeted into oblivion because of these numbers of the Cincinnati
or in the off season says, oh, by the way, I've been playing all year with something that's torn in my shoulder or whatever. I mean, obviously that's changes the narrative. All right, let's move on to another one of these players, and I'm going to let you pick. I'm going to throw out a couple of names, and you can pick. I'm going to pick two names that are like top 25 guys in Trevor Story and Christian Yelich, and then two guys that are kind of those younger players I think people were hoping to get a little bit more out of this year in Ke'Bryan Hayes and Andrew Vaughn.
All right. We'll come back to the young kids. They've actually been not that bad. But let's talk about Trevor's story to start here. As of today, we're recording on Wednesday. This is the 8th. Our good friend Mikey Ahedo has put out a really interesting piece about Trevor's story for Baseball Prospectus. Good for him.
Yeah.
Going, getting published in some cool places. that basically just talks about how he's doing all of the same things as last year and the results just haven't been as good. And the one thing that is different is, well, I'll let you guess, what's changed between this year and last year?
For a story? Or just in general? The baseball?
In general. Yeah.
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 Okay. I thought you were really trying to throw me a curveball. I'll see myself out.
Please do. it's really interesting to look at him. His like a total number of extra base hits. This isn't a particular number that Mikey cites, but it's one that I kind of went and like, it was like, is Mikey right? And I was like, oh yeah, of course he is. his total number of extra base hits, like per 100 plate appearances, is like almost identical. Pretty much all the underlying numbers look the same. He's still striking out and is still like mid 20s plays. He's still hitting about the same number of barrels and all that stuff. And the results just aren't as good because it seems like, finally, there is drag on the baseball in Colorado, and that is leading to an outcome where it does not land in the bleachers as often for Mr. Trevor Story.
Mm-hmm.
He is probably just as talented as he's ever been. Probably. I don't know. He's getting slightly older, but not meaningfully.
Yeah, right.
It's not like he's been like really big hurt or anything like that.
Right.
So we talked preseason. A lot of people talk preseason about who the D-juice ball was going to hurt most, and it was the sort of people who had a whole lot of balls that just barely went over the fence, but gave themselves a lot of opportunities, because you take 4 feet off of a lot of opportunities, that's going to be a whole lot more doubles. Now, he's been lucky. Colorado is such a big park to hit into that he's reaping the rewards in terms of a lot of doubles. He's at like 30 on the year, 31, something like that. And you know, previous years he played a full season, wasn't on that sort of pace. Now the home runs, not there.
Right.
That's a problem.
So in especially in a roto league where you're not really getting any credit for a double versus a single.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. You can make a similar case that a lot of the regression that we've seen from Francisco Lindor, by the way, is very similar to the sort of regression we've seen. Now, Lindor also has the extra problem of Citi Field is a little bit less friendly than the confines in Cleveland. But still, like, you can apply this same like idea here, that volume, like, balls to the outfield guys who don't just smash 115 miles an hour off the bat are having trouble this year. DJ LeMahieu, another name.
Yeah.
Really obvious. He's not even at double-digit home runs yet. It's very clear that that's an element of this. Now, another part of Story in particular, he tends to hit the ball to all fields. He does definitely not just try to pull the ball all of the time, which a lot of these other guys do, which means, you know, he's losing the opposite field home runs in particular. So, you know.
I want to put you on the spot here. I'm going to put you a little bit to the test, and maybe it'll take you a second to look something up, and that's fine. If you were going to write the Trevor Story is a bust next year article, what stat would you lead with? And if you were going to write the Trevor Story is value next year, what's the stat you would lead with?
Oh, man. So I think it's all going to come down to price for him. He's really, really helpful in that, like, we actually know who he is.
Sure. I guess what I'm getting at is, like, if you're going to, like, if you're looking forward, and sure, ADP and value and all that is a factor, and I don't want to dismiss it, but I guess maybe I should rephrase what I'm trying to get at. Like, if you're looking, if you're making the case that Trevor's story is going to be bad next year, what's the stat that kind of hints at the fact that he might be bad next year? And if you think Trevor Story is going to be just fine next year, what's the stat that hints at the fact that he might be just fine next year? That's more what I mean. It's totally fair that ADP, is going to come into play in terms of bust and all that sort of stuff. So that's my bad on the phrasing.
you're fine.
Let's look at. I just want to kind of
positive number. What's the negative number for him? Right. Yeah, I would say that the more positive outlook for him is going to pretty much come down to the fact that he's almost guaranteed to be in a better offensive environment, and all of the other analysis we do is always so vacuumy.
Yeah. I was actually going to make that point, too, at the end, and yeah, just say, I also have to imagine that for him, it's probably hard to get up to that plate and be super amped and into it at this point. But that's a whole other set of variables. So I guess in terms of off-season prep work for your draft, if I want to convince myself story's going to be great, I guess what you're looking at are going to be things like max exit velocity. You're going to look at line drive rate, stuff like that, and make sure that stuff is on par.
I think that the thing about him is it's not like this season has dramatically altering what we know about his talents. This is like a really almost feels like alchemy or wish casting a lot of the time, is that when you try to determine how talented someone is, it kind of doesn't show up in a discernible way. And there's a whole lot of people who like to do a lot of things with numbers to try to chase after that rabbit, and it just doesn't appear no matter how many times you do linear regression, because choices matter. And you're in the opposing pitcher does not need to choose to give you anything worth hitting. Have you seen some of the lineups that they're rolling out every day?
That's right. Why would you go after Trevor Story at this point? Right. So
if Trevor Story signs with the Detroit Tigers next year, and the Baltimore Orioles, or someone who is also not all that scary, but maybe a little bit more scary, he would improve. If he signs with the New York Yankees in the offseason, my willingness to draft him is going to be pretty high. Okay. I definitely think that, a lot of that is going to come down to those sorts of things, because, at this point, we don't think that he's hurt. We don't think that he's pressing. He's probably just seeing a bunch of junk. You know where we could look that up? Is we can go look at his own.
Talk this through as we go. This is awesome. This is teachable moment. So talk us through exactly what you're doing. Where are you going and what are you looking for and why?
Yeah. So the hypothesis here, right, to be scientific, we teach this to sixth graders. It hasn't gone away. The hypothesis here is he's probably seeing more junk than usual because the team's more bad than usual. Okay. Let's go. Actually, I'm going to check one thing. His past 2 years. Really, really whack, unsustainable line drive rates over 30%. This year, 25 league average. So he has regressed to the mean a little bit over past years. So I've missed that actually from previous years. Now, he didn't turn those gigantic line drive numbers into huge barrel numbers, which would tell us though that he was getting a good number of non-barreled home runs, which are pretty much just barely over the fence home runs.
Yeah, exactly. The kind that are going to be affected by a deadened ball. Yeah, absolutely.
There you go. And those will also, the line drives he was getting that weren't barrels are also just going to be base hits and are going to inflate his batting average. His expected batting average has benefited from those. Mm-hmm. But, he's batting, 249 this year? That feels right. When the line drives dry up, your batting average goes down, because a lot of those are singles, by the way, that turn into ground nuts or flyouts whenever they regress.
Yeah.
Okay. But checking his zone rates and stuff like that will tell us about the sort of quality of the stuff that he's seeing. So this year, it's actually up. Huh. That's interesting. His zone contact looks the same. His chase stuff looks the same. He's striking out about the same amount.
What about pitch type? Can you look at that? Is the pitch mix different? Is that something you can?
He's seeing a few fewer fastballs. Yeah, but nothing dramatically crazy. Yeah, this merits some more looking. I would say that a lot of it is just the unluckiness of the ball changing and some regression and luck. And how many guys this is going to be the story on? It kind of gets boring almost. It's not boring, right? You just realize how many guys, Michael Conforto, I traded for him earlier this year, and after I traded, I was all of his success last year. Same thing. And there's so many guys you can find this fun. There are more interesting stories, I promise. But for Story, I do think that he's a good example of, the story might be that. Oh, God, that's a terrible pun.
We have said the word story a lot.
Okay. Now, you also asked about Christian Yelich, and I just wanted to say, I don't really want to touch that too much because I don't have a good answer other than that I think he's hurt.
And, yeah, that's fair. What about like Cody Bellinger then instead? And we don't have to spend 10 minutes. Same idea. Think he's hurt. Yeah. It's weird to see.
A lot of really good research. Can I butt in here really
quickly?
Yeah,
no, please do.
That suggests that if you play while hurt,
yeah,
it affects you long term.
Yeah, that makes sense. Of course. That's my big concern with Tatis Jr., honestly. He's still putting up numbers, but I really do hope that he hasn't hurt his longevity in the game. But that's a totally different discussion for a different day. So if we're looking at Yelich and Bellinger and potentially being hurt, then what does that mean for draft day? Is that like is that a do not draft list? If we don't know, if no news comes out in the offseason and we're just kind of hoping, is that just something you stay away from?
It's the sort of thing where spring training data would actually be interesting if we had good spring training data from StatCast spring training parks, where we could see things like max exit velocity. We'll also be able to just kind of watch, like for Yelich, it was just like out of nowhere last year. Suddenly he was whiffing at everything and he's kind of kept a little bit of that up.
Yeah.
You remember like the narrative coming in the draft day is, oh, he fixed it in the second half of the season. Well, he's still been hurt. So those are the sorts of things where you probably just really, really hard avoid, and maybe you set yourself a floor for him. And if it comes to it on draft day in like December, if you're in like one of those like way early drafts, there comes a moment when you pull the trigger. Personally, for me, like whenever I'm getting ready to do some of those sorts of activities, I probably am not taking Yelich in the top 50 as of right now, but it's probably about 55, 60. Whereas for Bellinger, it's like, it's got to be outside the top 100.
He's been very bad. And now, I mean, there's even playing time concerns, right? I mean, they've already said they're just platooning him at this point. And who knows how long that carries over. I mean, managers kind of do get stuck in things. I'm curious about this, and then we can maybe just lump in the youngsters together. And you make a good point that they haven't been bad, but I think part of the reason I want to bring up youngsters is that maybe we really put too many unfair expectations on what a phenomenal future player is going to look like in their first couple of years. But I'm really curious as to what you think is going on with Tommy Pham.
So I could not tell you in some ways. In that I
what would you okay
I knew
so,
what the story was I knew what the story was
yeah
and it's not it's we've told it actually a couple times today. I did a thread earlier in the season about why he was so bad early in the year, and lo and behold, for him it wasn't line drive stuff, it was that he was phenomenally unlucky on hard hit balls in play,
which you would think would normalize at some point.
It did. Yeah, at one point. Well, when you say normalize, really what it means is just at some point the pass doesn't matter as long as the player isn't pressing.
Right, that's what I mean. Slump, like, he's going to stop being unlucky. It doesn't necessarily mean he's going to get super lucky to counteract it, but at some point that bad fortune should stop. But again, you don't have to necessarily give me an answer. I think more importantly, this is about process and you know what you decide about where you're going to take Yelich or Bellinger or Pham next year could be completely different from people listening, but I am very interested in the process and exactly what numbers you're looking at to kind of justify that. And even if you come to a different conclusion than somebody, we can at least give them the blueprint for how to go and try and make that decision for themselves.
Yeah. I think that Pham is, if his season long numbers the first month or so really screwed with him. He had a pretty good middle of the year. And lately, he's just kind of been the odd man out to a degree because he's right-handed, I think.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. And part of it, you know, is if you're going to leave someone on the bench, you leave a right-handed player on the bench.
Yeah.
So some part of it is like, regardless of how good he's been, air quotes, second half of the season, he's just likely to kind of sit.
Roll an opportunity.
If you look at things like his.
Yeah.
If you look at stuff like. What I would love to look at for a guy like him is I'm going to take the, you can go to Savant's, it's like the breakdowns tab and they get like the rolling charts and I'm going to throw up hard hit rate and I'm going to adjust the minimum balls in play to 200. And if you look at that, his hard hit rate has been stable all year. You look at his sweet spot rate and it was really terrible to start the year and it's dipped a little bit recently. You look at his strikeout rate, and you're just going to go through these. The strikeouts have ticked up a little bit over time, and that's probably the most concerning thing.
Yeah, okay.
But, you know, it doesn't seem like he's been fantastically terrible or anything like that.
Did you say fantastic?
I'm going to pretend I didn't, if that makes sense. Yeah, no, I mean, like, if you look at his stuff, like, he's got a 324 WOBA and a 349X WOBA. In spite of what has been a year-long, line drives look normal for him. He's always kind of, like, just below 25%. Here he is, just below 25%. Yeah, what you can see that gap in luck, though.
Yeah.
This is, like, the gap in luck that people can typically find. The difference between WOBA and X-WOBA is, you know, like, the fielder make the catch. And if you actually, I remember I went back through his, like, hard hit ball or his sweet spot balls in play numbers early in the year. And there's just a ton of fantastic plays by defenders.
Mm.
And it happens.
It does. Happens, yeah. You definitely can't control that. All right. Let's talk about the youngsters.
I'm fully unconcerned about him.
I really want to get your take on this because I think what you said is fair. They haven't been bad. But I definitely think it's fair to say that they haven't been what people were really hoping they would be. Now, different situations in terms of when they were available and all of that. But my idea here in bringing this up is twofold. One, what's going on with them so that we can make good decisions about next year? Is there a trend in the right direction in the underlying data that suggests that there's a breakout coming? And two, and this is probably something that you would have to spend more time on, but, you know, if you compare what they've done to other rookies or youngsters who have gone on to have really good careers, is it really out of whack? And my guess would be no. And I would really want to get to the idea that we put too much pressure on these kids to come up and be the thing they're going to be in 3 or 4 years, which is a fair expectation. And people are kind of expecting it right away, but, let's pick one and just let that be the model for this. You can go with Hayes or Vaughn. It doesn't really matter to me. Or if you want to throw a wild card, you can pick somebody else that you'd rather talk about. But kind of as the model of how do we make good decisions about young players?
So let me take like a 45 second sidetrack on Cabrian Hayes before talking about Andrew Vaughn.
Okay.
Do you want to guess why Cabrian Hayes batted, what was it, like 340 last year? It was 376 through 95 plate appearances.
Yeah, I mean, fun with small samples.
Yeah, do you want to know what in particular it was that prompted that batting average to be so high?
Sure.
It was his 32% line drive rate.
Mm-hmm.
He also just smoked the ball a ton. We didn't expect that. He got absolute perfect contact on quite a few balls that wasn't like hit hard enough to be out, but hard enough to be like a lot of doubles, I think, was,
which might speak more to pitcher decisions, right? Like, okay, kid, hit this, and then he did, right? And then you can make adjustments to that.
Yeah, that totally is it. You can see his fastball rate last year was above 60%. That is way too high for anyone who's good. That is rookie treatment. And this year, it's gone down. It's into like the mid-50s, upper 50s, something like that. And you'll notice his zone contact rate has dropped from 93.7%, which is, by the way, really fantastic.
Yeah.
You cannot fake that, to the upper 80s. Still
doing
it. He's chasing a little bit less this year, which is really good to see. He's missed a little bit more, but like still, those are good bat-to-ball skills. It's just like, if you should not expect his 55% hard hit rate to stay alive if they're adjusting to him. And also, he was smoking the ball because he was just perfect contact. Line drive rate this year, 19%.
Yeah.
He's going to turn around.
So
I have worries about him.
Okay, so those numbers tell me, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that the talent certainly has not changed, which you wouldn't expect in a young player. If you put too much stock in what he did in 90 plate appearances, that was pretty silly. And that he'll probably grow into being better than what he was this year. But if you expect somebody to be a 360 hitter in this day and age, that's pretty unrealistic. So you're fine drafting him at fair value, going into next season.
Yeah. He doesn't steal a ton. And he was never a guy that flashed like elite raw power tools in the minors. His max EV still is only at 111 his career. That's not outstanding.
Right.
But you can be Matt Chapman light.
Sure.
And that's kind of what he might be in some respects.
Do you think he also Matt Chapman light suffers slightly from his surroundings?
Oh, yeah, probably. Yeah. Yeah, no doubt there.
Yeah.
Now, it is a beautiful set of surroundings.
So I don't, yeah, I don't mean the aesthetic.
Now, for Vaughn, I want to say his is much more interesting.
Okay.
For Hayes, it's just like simple. People don't go looking for explanations about why someone did something really outlierish.
Right, yeah.
Now, for Vaughn,
if
this
it's good,
story is much more
right?
interesting.
That's what you mean. Yeah. If they're doing so, really well, people want to believe it's real and not you look at Suarez and he's been bad. People are digging to figure out why somebody in 100 plate appearances is off the charts, and people are just like, oh, he must just be that good.
Expectations.
You got to manage your expectations.
Yeah, no, I think all of the signs about Andrew Vaughn though are mm-hmm. just like arrow up. Like yeah. this dude will be a top 50 producer within the next two seasons. Like this dude looks so legit. And part of that is that he's made adjustments this year. Mm. Well, doing things really well to begin with. He's been a bit unlucky. And it's been like the sort of like fielder in the right place kind of unlucky. Not the contact. His line drive stuff looks fine. But in terms of, and this is something I pulled up earlier today because I wanted to make sure I could cite this. In terms of his hard hit per PA rate, which is my favorite stat for measuring the consistency of hitters,
yeah,
because hard hit balls are what you need to get on base, and you measure it per PA because those are your opportunities. If
right.
if you basically add hard hit plus walks, you can end up with a really nice combination of just like how many of your PAs turn out good.
Mm.
But yeah, no, it's hard to pull that up in Statcast really easily because I can't throw in walks and stuff at the same time. I sort that later, and I will definitely look into that later this offseason. But Vaughn has just been crushing the ball all year. He is out of, let me make sure I get the correct number of batters here. I set the bar at 200 PAs, so you get 327 hitters. He is 43rd out of 327 hitters. That is like the 88th percentile in hard hit PA. That is 32.2% of his plate appearances are hard hit balls. That is sandwiched between Nick Castellanos and Jose Ramirez.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not a bad place to be.
And the thing is, the arrow is pointing up. He's been getting better.
Yeah.
Since the All-Star break, roughly, he's just dramatically cut his strikeout rate. I want to make sure I can kind of get this. See, yeah, you grab the rolling charts. Yeah. Let me make sure I can grab the actual thing. I'm going to go back to his page here so I can cite this exactly. But I'm going to set for strikeouts. A 50 PA sample is fine because those actually come to normalize really quickly. So he was striking out upper 20% of the time before the All-Star break. Since then, he's somewhere around 15.
Hmm. Okay.
If you're hitting the ball as hard as him
and striking out at 15%, yeah,
that's really scary.
Really, really good. Yeah,
that's really, really scary.
So if people are off him because they're just looking at those top level numbers, there's a lot of room for value there.
Now I think. And here's a nice little place for us to kind of land the aircraft for the day, so to speak. The story for him does show up in terms of his ex-Woba. And yet, I still think there's potential for us to like kind of like write away some of how cool this has been on the year. Right? So he's got... the reason I don't like hard hit rate, but I'm gonna bring it up anyway, and people are going to cite it. I don't like hard hit rate because players who put the ball into play more often instead of striking out are penalized by it.
Yeah,
the difference
right.
between a weak hit ground ball and a strikeout is that if a weak hit ground ball can still be a single. And if you hit the same number of hard hit balls, but you strike out more, your hard hit rate goes up.
Right.
Which is dumb. And I don't like it. quote me on that as much as you want. But, you know, in spite of him having on the year, it's now a 21% strikeout rate. That'll go down. He's at a 47% hard hit rate. So that's people are going to like that.
Yeah.
His WOBA is at 319. His ex-WOBA is at 334. Mm. That's a little bit unlucky, not a whole lot. That's going to go up because, again, the strikeouts are going to go down. So if you're not like looking at the arrows on these sorts of things, you're not going to catch some of these things. But I just want to say all of the news on Vaughn is very good. He's been screwed around by batting order. He's been screwed around by lack of consistent playing time. He hasn't always been able to get all of his platoon advantage somehow. Like, he's right-handed. Play him against all the lefties. He doesn't... It's been totally inexplicable.
Mm-hmm.
He's been easily, though, I think, on the year, the White Sox second or third best hitter. Like it's Abreu, and then you can make an argument about whether it's him, Grandal, or Tim Anderson, and I would put him above the other two currently. Wow. I think he is better than either of those guys. Yeah. And I mean, Eli's been hurt, so, but like it would not be crazy at all to see Andrew Vaughn be better than Eloy Jimenez over the next 2 or 3 years.
Wow, that's amazing. I mean, that would be great. I'm rooting for him. I really am.
They're kind of similar in some respects. Yeah, so we'll watch that bit.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm really excited about draft Andrew Vaughn. I want to really do a quick hit here on pass-fail and then see if we can wrap this up in under an hour for the first time perhaps ever. But this is really something that I am extraordinarily curious about from your point of view, especially the analytical point of view. Pass-fail, using the last week of the regular baseball season to determine fantasy playoffs, especially championships.
Fail. All right, let's go home.
Good. Well, we agree. Yeah. I hate it too. There are
some Roto. I'm fine with it. Yes. Anything with playoffs, it's a hard pass.
That's why I included playoffs because I think that's really the Roto. You're including the whole season. It is what it is. But anything with playoffs, yeah, okay. I as well. I was expecting a little bit more of a. Well, you know, this number of players don't play, and you have much more variation, and I didn't get it. So that's okay. Yeah, that's all right, though.
One of my first games I went to in Camden Yards when I moved to Baltimore was a meaningless game between the Orioles and the Astros at the end of the season, in which neither of them played their starters. Now, for Baltimore at that point, it was not noticeable, but Houston basically sat everybody.
Yeah.
It's going to be a little harder for that to make, like, or to rear its head in the same way with the less expanded rosters. We're probably going to see more full strength, air quotes, lineups. But don't be surprised if with about 10 games to go, if we don't see someone, air quotes, hitting the IL for something so that they can call up someone. It'll be Chicago who could do this, or maybe, probably not Houston, who could screw around like that. Like, this is like the Dodgeritis whenever they had the division on lock. Mm-hmm. Someone else might play around like that.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't suspect it'd be more than one or two guys at max, if at all. And it's probably gonna be pitchers, if at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair point. So maybe it has less of an impact this year than it would in years past. But there's nothing worse than going into a championship week and losing because your studs aren't playing. That's very frustrating.
Now, I mean, they'll probably still play less. The bench will still play.
Yeah,
but right. I would expect that if you're relying on Carlos Correa or Jose Altuve, for example, because I think the Astros will have their division locked up for the last week, probably just the last week, but the last week.
Mm-hmm.
I bet you that you're going to see pretty much everyone in their starting lineup getting every other game off, and then the bench guys basically play all week. And that allows them to kind of rotate around. So,
yeah, that makes some sense. And it'll happen to your opponent too, but still, it just adds a whole new level of luck that I don't really like. All right, well, that's going to bring us to the end of this episode, right at the 1 hour mark, Alexander. We did it.
We did it.
If you could go ahead and let the people know where they can find us.
Well, they can find you on Twitter at TheCorkedMatt. I'm on Twitter at Chase_rate. And most importantly, you can find our podcast on Twitter at Dugout Study Hall, where you can send us some questions. Please be sure to subscribe to the Pitcherless podcast feed if you haven't done that already. Leave us a good review if you can be so kind. And if you're not already, please consider becoming a PL Plus member so that you can harass us on the PL Discord. And that's it for me.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll catch you next time.
What an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like. X, go give it to you. How about that?
That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Beosonic sound experience. That's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it? Let's go. Give it to you. Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S. Give up. Order now at Acura.com.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well, then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
I know how to run a hair salon, but for small business insurance, I chose my State Farm agent. She's a small business owner, too, so she knew how to help me personalize my policies. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to an agent today.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.